So with that, Rami, let's get started on the announcement made by the Trump or the Netanyahu regime that the war criminal will be coming to Washington yet again. This will be the sixth trip to the United States for Netanyahu since Trump returned to the White House less than 13 months ago. He's coming on average once every 2 months or so. I've never seen anything like it. It's off the charts. No other world leader has come to the U.S. that often since Trump's inauguration in January 2025. No one even comes close. And I doubt that there's been any world leader, even during the Second World War, that came to the United States six times in the space of a little more than 1 year. So something's going on, and we're going to try to delve into what that is exactly. Trump and Netanyahu are scheduled to meet in Washington in 3 days' time on Wednesday of this week. So why is the Israeli war criminal coming yet again? Rami, if you could pull up number one. This is the line that is being repeated by all Israeli media. Netanyahu is coming to address the U.S.-Iran talks and to tell Trump that it is not enough to get a deal on nuclear enrichment. Any deal has to address Iran's missiles and proxies. And what we're hearing is that the evil monster is insisting that Iran effectively deprive itself of the ability to strike Israel with ballistic conventional missiles or any missiles, and that it cut off all support for other resistance groups. And this is not just what you see up on the screen there is a report from the Times of Israel, but this is the unanimous message of all of the Israeli media. When I checked this morning, Haaretz, Ynet, and the Jerusalem Post, in addition to the Times of Israel, they were all repeating that mantra. This is about the negotiations with Iran and Netanyahu's insistence that all three of those issues be on the table.
Dimitri. Do you feel like, because Trump spoke about reducing Iran's ballistic missiles to under 300 kilometers, do you feel like this is an endorsement that Iran actually made extensive damage to Israel during the 12-day war, and that Iran in some way is an existential threat to Israel?
Well, whether they understand, I think Iran is an existential threat to it, that tiny pipsqueak of a genocidal country. But I think you're absolutely right, Rami, that the insistence that Iran basically neuter itself from a missile perspective does show that they are very, very concerned, as does the fact that they have not yet attacked Iran. They are extremely concerned about Iran's ballistic missile capability, obviously. I think the Iranians quite properly are saying that's the only thing that's protecting us right now. So if we give up the ability to strike the genocidal pipsqueak and, and American military bases that are more than 300 kilometers from Iran, then we will have no effective deterrent. And then we're going to go the way of the dodo bird. They're going to destroy us the way they've destroyed Syria and try to dismember us. And we'll come back to that. But that's a very important point, Rami. This is proof of how much they fear Iran's ballistic missiles. Now, the prime minister's office said, quote, "The prime minister believes that any negotiations must include restrictions on ballistic missiles and an end to support for the Iranian axis." And I'm going to comment on the negotiating positions of the parties later on. But I just want to note that Iran has said very clearly that it is not going to put ballistic missiles on the negotiating table. That's not touchable. Its support for the axis of resistance is not touchable. It has been consistent in that regard. And it's also said that it will not terminate its nuclear enrichment program. At the most, it will accept significant limits on the degree to which it will enrich uranium, but it already did that under the JCPOA. It agreed to a level of something like 3.67% of enrichment, which is marginally below the level needed for a civilian nuclear program, which is about 5%, and far below uranium. So, and what happened, Trump tore up the deal during his first administration, even though the IAEA certified that Iran was complying with the deal. So again, we'll come back to the negotiating positions later on. I have no doubt, I want to say at the outset, as I explain what I think is going on here, that Netanyahu and Trump will in fact talk about Iran on Wednesday. I have no doubt about that. Iran might even be the main topic of their discussions. But for reasons I'm about to explain, I think that there's going to be at least one other topic on the table, and they don't want us to know that that topic is preoccupying them. And of course, I'm referring here to the Epstein files. Now, to explain to you why I think the Epstein files will be near the top of their agenda, if not at the top of their agenda, I'd like to revisit with you all what happened in late 2025, just a couple of months ago. So on November 19th, 2025, Trump signed into law the Epstein Files Transparency Act after it became apparent to him that he could not stop Congress from adopting the legislation and he could not overcome, or that Congress would effectively overcome any veto that he applied because there was almost unanimous support for this legislation in Congress. So he signs it into law on November 19th. By the way, I did a report about a week after that, which talked about the defects in this law. So, for example, it allows documents to be withheld or redacted for national security reasons. That's a big one. You can imagine them saying, well, anything that compromises our ability to defend Israel is a national security issue. Therefore, we're going to withhold information relating to Israel. They also, Thomas Massie, Ro Khanna and the others who pushed this legislation allowed the legislation to contain a loophole for documents that are withheld because disclosing them might prejudice an ongoing investigation by the DOJ. This was ridiculous because Trump was saying that there's no basis to investigate anybody at this stage. It was all, Epstein, who they say is dead, and Ghislaine Maxwell, who's already in prison. So there's nothing to investigate. So why would they have an exception for ongoing investigations? But probably the worst defect in this law was that it did not specify a penalty for non-compliance. So it didn't say that, you know, if the Trump administration doesn't comply, then it will be held in contempt of Congress, or that there will be potential jail time for those who violate the law, that there will be massive fines. It didn't lay out any kind of procedure for pursuing or imposing a penalty for non-compliance. So this is a very weak law. And although, you know, I do commend Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna for doing at least that much, we should stop talking about this law as though it was some kind of panacea. In my opinion, what this was designed to do was basically to calm the mob. And I'm a member of that mob, the mob that is demanding accountability. So I think this is a way for them to drip feed information to us until all the perps are basically dead, and to withhold the most damning information. The Democrats, they have the ability on the Oversight Committee to put out a much more information than they have. They've only put out a fraction of the information that they're able to put out. When they were in power, they did nothing, absolutely nothing, even when they had the majority in Congress and the Senate to release this information. So the cover-up is bipartisan. And I think this legislation is more cosmetics than a real effort to impose accountability. But it's something. It's something. In any case, it gets signed into law on November 19th. And the law specified that the legislation, or that the Trump regime was required to release the Epstein files, all of them, except those that were within the exceptions that I cited, national security and ongoing investigations, by December 21st. Okay, it's about 30 days. So on November 19th, it was known at that moment that the Trump regime would have to disclose the Epstein files by December 21st. What happens? On December 12th, about 3 weeks after Trump signed the new law, Netanyahu's office announced that Netanyahu would come to Washington near the end of December for the fifth visit since Trump returned to the White House, the fifth visit in less than a year. Then on December 20th, the day before the Department of Justice was required to release the Epstein files and did release some of them, NBC News reported that when Trump would come to the U.S. at the end of December, he planned to brief, when Netanyahu, I'm sorry, would come to the U.S. at the end of December, he planned to brief Trump on Israeli plans to strike Iran. So if you could pull up image two, Rami, we'll see there the headline of this big article. And you can see in the section I've highlighted, it says this: Israeli officials have grown increasingly concerned that Iran is expanding production of its ballistic missile program, which was damaged by Israeli military strikes earlier this year, and are preparing to brief President Donald Trump about options for attacking it again, according to a person with direct knowledge of the plans, and four former U.S. officials briefed on the plans. So that tells you right there that this is a psyop. This isn't one person, you know, deciding they're going to leak information for reasons of conscience. There's coordination going on here between unnamed officials to convince the public that the reason why Netanyahu is going to come to the United States at the end of December is exclusively, because no other reason is mentioned, to talk about Israeli plans to attack Iran. Okay? So you can remove that, Rami. Thank you very much.
Before we do that, there's a Steve Bannon email to Jeffrey Epstein, because again, we've been really deep into these Epstein files over the last week or so. And one of them is an email from Epstein asking Bannon, how do you keep control of a population when it's about to revolt? And Bannon responds by saying, starting a war somewhere else, like invading another country, is a great way of keeping your population in check, because it keeps everyone focused into this new issue. So I feel like in some way, this whole Iran debacle happening at the same time as the Epstein files is kind of proving exactly what Steve Bannon was referring to.
Absolutely. And it's more than Iran, which I'm gonna discuss in just a second, but you're absolutely right. And indeed, this is rebellion caliber material. This is what we're talking. This is the type of thing that topples governments and heads of states, and even causes particularly irate citizens, the peasants, to pull out the pitchforks. So let's then continue with what happens next. So on the 20th, these you know, five officials, all of them unnamed, go to the corporate media in the US and say, oh, he's coming to talk about plans to strike Iran. The next day comes the first dump of Epstein documents under the Epstein Files Transparency Act. And from that moment, from the moment that I remember this very clearly, and I was very gratified to see this, the Epstein Files scandal dominated the news cycle right up until the end of December. Like if you looked at the corporate media and particularly the alternative media, this was the number one subject, and people were coming up with all sorts of stinking, smelling, vile dirt about Epstein and all of these psychopathic billionaires who frequented his dens of depravity. And then Netanyahu arrives in Washington at the very end of December. So by that point in time, I think it's fair to say that, you know, Trump and Netanyahu, and not just them, but the people around them and the neocons and the billionaire class, were all deeply concerned about the public's preoccupation with the information that was released on December 21st. So the files showed us, amongst many other things, that Trump and Israel both had deeper connections to Epstein than many of us had understood. And I want to just remind people about what I was saying during that week after this story appeared in NBC News about why Netanyahu was coming to Washington again. My interpretation of these events was that was a planted story to distract people from the primary purpose, or at least one of the main purposes, of Netanyahu coming to Washington, which was to talk about the Epstein scandal. Because it's a given, it's just a given that every time Netanyahu and Trump get together, they're talking about, you know, somehow attacking Iran. They're obsessed with Iran. Iran is the key to resistance to Western hegemony in this very important region of the world. So they are absolutely fanatically determined to destroy Iran. And it's not news. It's not some kind of, you know, scoop or breaking story to tell us that when Netanyahu meets with Trump, they're going to be talking about Iran. You should assume they always talk about Iran when they get together. Okay, this has been an obsession with Netanyahu going back decades. So why were they planting this story then? I believed, and I said this at the time, it was a distraction because what was really happening was that Netanyahu was panicking about the Epstein files, and he wanted to talk to Donald about stopping the catastrophe from getting any worse, the public relations catastrophe, and find ways of, you know, distracting people from what those that document dump revealed about Israel and Epstein. So I talked about this, by the way, not only on this show several times. I also talked about this on other programs when I was interviewed, including the Jamal Thomas show. And as far as I know, no one else in the alternative media was arguing that a major reason for Netanyahu's fifth visit to Washington at the end of December was likely to be some kind of, you know, hatching of a plan to deal with the scandal, the burgeoning Epstein scandal. So almost immediately after Netanyahu met with Trump in late December, both corporate and alternative media outlets stopped focusing on Epstein. What happened? First of all, riots erupted in Iran. And we know from statements by former CIA director and the Mossad itself that Mossad agents were involved in important ways in those riots. That's not to say that there weren't legitimate grievances. It's not to say that they started the protests, although Scott Bessent, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, has said straight up that engineered a sharp decline in the Iranian currency for the purpose of provoking protests, and it worked. He's now said this twice, at least twice publicly. So I'm pretty sure that they were talking about that too when they met at the end of December. But there was much more stuff going on. There was the kidnapping on January 3rd, something like 2 or 3 days after Netanyahu and Trump met, of President Nicolas Maduro from Caracas, which was a criminal violation of the most fundamental precepts of the UN Charter, but it didn't actually result in a change in government. Maybe, you know, Delcy Rodriguez, and I've been talking about this in my reporting for Venezuela over the last week, you know, is going to be somewhat more cooperative than Nicolas Maduro. Until now, there are plenty of indications that she's going to continue, and the people around her, who are all from Nicolas Maduro's government, are going to continue to try their best to protect the sovereignty of Venezuela. So there was that distraction. And then on top of all this, in the lead up to the World Economic Forum in Davos from January 19th to 23rd, Trump was flapping his gums and spewing hot air on an almost daily basis about how the United States was going to take Greenland. Remember that? And so Trump goes to Davos after, you know, intimating that maybe the U.S. would use even military force and threatening to impose sanctions on Europe, you know, crushing sanctions if it didn't allow the United States to effectively confiscate Greenland. He goes to Davos and he folds up like a cheap suit. And he says, well, no, I'm not going to use military force. And, I'm not going to impose sanctions. I'm not going to use tariffs to try to do this, but we're going to find a way. Now, I'm not suggesting that Trump doesn't really genuinely want to take control of Greenland. I believe he does. And I'm not suggesting he doesn't really want regime change in Venezuela. I believe he does. Nor am I suggesting that all of the military assets he sent to the region after he met with Netanyahu, that was another thing that dominated the public discourse, that they aren't ultimately going to be used to attack Iran. They may well be used to attack Iran. But so far, what we've seen during the month of January was a lot of hot air. It was a lot of hot air. The Iranian government is still firmly in place. The Chavista government is still firmly in place. There hasn't been a bombing of Iran. And Trump has folded up like a cheap suit on Greenland. But all of this, you know, posturing worked. It worked to distract people from the Epstein scandal, which, as I've said in other contexts, in my opinion, is the most important scandal of our time. Now, Go ahead, Remy.
Just a little question here is that couldn't the Americans, or sorry, the United States find an easier way to distract us from the Epstein files, such as not releasing the files at all?
Well, then they would have no argument that they're complying with the law. I think Netanyahu believed when Trump came to the White House that none of those documents would ever see the light of day. But what happened was, you know, there was so much pressure on Congress, because let's replay this during the presidential campaign and even before the presidential campaign in 2024, in order to win the votes of all the Americans out there, Democrats, Republicans, independents, who were outraged by what we knew about Epstein and his billionaire psychopathic friends, the pressure caused people in Congress to say, we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to give them something. And this led ultimately to the adoption of this law. Remember that Trump was eviscerating any Republican, including in particular Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I have to say, I admire her stand on this particular issue. Eviscerating anybody who said that they were going to go on board with that law. But when it suddenly at the 11th hour became apparent that his threats weren't working, and I think there was like one Republican who was saying he was going to oppose this thing, and he wouldn't be able, you know, even if he vetoed the legislation, they were going to be able to overcome the veto because they can do that with 2/3 of the support of Congress. So at the 11th hour, Trump caved because he knew he couldn't stop the law and he wanted to seem like he actually supported the law. So I think that this was not what Netanyahu and Trump imagined, that this law would be forced upon them. And then they were going to have to release at least some of the documents to convince the public that they were coming clean. Okay, so this is the their plan went awry, and I think their plan was no disclosure. Remember what happened? How people were upset when Pam Bondi said, "Oh, there is no list of clients after all," and Bongino and Cash Patel said, "Oh, there's nothing to see here, folks. Move on." This was completely contrary to what all these characters were saying in the run-up to the 2024 election. So it all went awry for them, and so this is how we now find ourselves where we currently are. So to close out my sort of recounting of how this has unfolded, we come to January 21st. You know, the first dump of documents was a small fraction of the documents that were supposed to be released, and a lot of those were heavily redacted. So on January 21st, January 30th, this is about a week after Davos, the Department of Justice releases 3 million plus pages of highly disturbing, shocking, and incriminating documents from the Epstein files. A lot of it is kind of insignificant, banal, but there is a tremendous amount of extremely compromising material in there, and we are only beginning to process it all. We're going to talk to you about some stuff that Remy is working on, some really interesting discoveries that he's made. We're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but we ourselves here, and a lot of people in independent media, a lot of just ordinary citizen journalists, interested members of the public, are themselves finding damning material every single day, and there's a lot more to come, I'm sure. So on January 30th, we get this dump, and all of a sudden, we're back to where we were on December 21st, which is that the Epstein scandal is dominating the news cycle. Now it's the number one story. Nobody's talking, or few people are talking about Venezuela, few people are talking about Greenland, if anybody. Even Iran has kind of taken second place. It is the number one story. And then we get to the announcement that Netanyahu is returning to Washington for his sixth visit. Now, I just want to, before I go on, highlight for you why I think the January 30th disclosure is freaking out the Netanyahu regime. And if you can pull up document number 3, Rami, this is a one of the documents that was released. It is a CHS reporting document generated by the FBI. CHS means confidential human source. This is from October 19th, 2020. Okay. We don't know who the source is. The name has been redacted or withheld, and the case agent's name has been redacted there as well. But the source says, amongst other things, this: Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz, he's talking about CHS, the confidential human source, learned that Dershowitz influenced many students from wealthy families. For example, Josh Kushner and Jared Kushner were both his students. Dershowitz told confidential human source, so the source says Dershowitz said this to him directly, that if he were young again, he would be holding a stun gun as an Israeli intelligence Mossad agent. CHS believed Dershowitz was co-opted by Mossad and subscribed to their mission. CHS still continues to communicate occasionally for Dershowitz. And then underneath, Jeffrey Epstein was represented by Dershowitz. CHS remembered Dershowitz tell Alex Acosta, U.S. Attorney, Southern District of Florida at the time, that Epstein belonged to both U.S. and allied intelligence services. CHS shared phone calls between Dershowitz and Epstein during which she took notes. After those calls, Mossad would then call Dershowitz to debrief. Epstein was close to the former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, and trained as a spy under him. And this is the Israeli Prime Minister who has, you know, we now know, stayed repeatedly, and sometimes for extended periods and sometimes with his wife, at Epstein's demonic New York mansion. The report goes on, says, Barak believed Netanyahu was a criminal. Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the UAE are allied against Qatar, Turkey, Iran, and Syria. One of CHS's blank, who presumably worked blanked, asked CHS a lot of questions about Epstein. CHS became convinced that Epstein was a co-opted Mossad agent. See previous reporting. So there's more of this information coming to the FBI. That's just one piece of the information that they have been given about Epstein being a Mossad agent. And remember, this is a man whom even the U.S. government acknowledges sexually abused over 1,200 young females, over 1,200. That's what they say. Some of them as young as 11. And by the way, I think that number is probably a gross understatement. And almost certainly many of those minors were abused by Epstein associates. And I also think that the age is probably being generous to Epstein. There's evidence we're encountering that some of these victims were much less than 11 years old. And there are even reports, as horrifying as it is, that there were babies that were abused. This is some of the stuff that's emerging from this material. So you don't want to be associated with this man if you are the Israeli government. You want to distance yourself as much as possible from this radioactive psychopath. So what happens, you know, about a week or a few days after the January 30th document dump by the DOJ, Netanyahu announces that he's rushing to Washington yet again. So I say to you folks, there's a little bit of a pattern here. I believe Netanyahu and Israel are freaking out, the Israeli political and military elite. As a result of their live stream genocide in Gaza and for a host of other reasons, Israel and the U.S. are now both global lepers. It's gotten so bad that the U.S. and Israeli athletes got booed on Friday at the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics. You know, I've been watching the Olympics. I haven't watched them in the recent past because I'm sick of them now. I can no longer stand them. But, you know, when I was a kid, I watched a lot. I don't remember athletes from any particular country getting booed, particularly the United States. It's getting pretty hostile out there for the genocidal entity and its Western backers. And by the way, just before this live stream started, I happened to be watching over lunch a report by Jean Taka, an excellent independent journalist who played video of four prominent U.S. athletes, each giving interviews in which, I think it was yesterday or the day before, they expressed shame, really, at what the United States is doing, and tried very, very hard to distance themselves from the criminality of the U.S. government, both at home and abroad. So the public relations situation for both Netanyahu and Trump has become dire. And for both of them, there are upcoming elections, you know, in both Israel and the United States. There are going to be midterms later this year. The Netanyahu regime, I understand, needs to go to the polls before the end of this year. So they're very, very concerned about where all of this is heading. And I think the most rational inference is that they are panicking and they're going to be talking about what to do about it when they meet in 3 days' time. Now, if you don't believe me or you have skepticism about, you know, whether Netanyahu himself is panicking, I think you need only look at his own statements. And he put out a tweet 2 days ago in which he went out of his way to distance Israel from Jeffrey Epstein. And he said, Jeffrey Epstein's unusual close relationship with Ehud Barak doesn't suggest Epstein worked for Israel. It proves the opposite. Stuck on his election loss from over two decades ago, Barak has for years obsessively attempted to undermine Israeli democracy. God. As if Netanyahu is the guardian of Israeli democracy. And he goes on, says, by working with the anti-Zionist radical left. Yeah, yeah, he's pro-Palestinian, Barak, sure. The war criminal, the bloodthirsty savage who has the blood of countless Palestinians on his hands. And he says that he attempted to overthrow Barak, the elected Israeli government. Barak's personal fixation led him to engage in activities publicly and behind the scenes to undermine the government of Israel, including fueling mass protest movements, fomenting unrest, and feeding false media narratives. What a pile of stinking bullshit. And, you know, the idea or any suggestion that Barak was no longer working in or for the state of Israel and its intelligence agencies after he ceased to be a minister in the government is laughable. You know, I think history has shown that, you know, membership in the genocidal Israeli regime is kind of like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. I don't believe for 1 second that Barak stopped working in some way for the state of Israel and its intelligence agencies when he ceased formally to be a minister in the government of Israel. But whatever you may think of Barak, the problem with this argument that Netanyahu is making is that it's not just Epstein's relationship with Barak, which strongly suggests, if not outright proves, that Epstein was working for Israeli intelligence. There's a lot more than that. This pathetic attempt to distance Israel from Epstein omitted to mention that Israeli spy Yoni Koren stayed at Epstein's New York mansion repeatedly and for extended periods. And we know this due to some wonderful reporting by DropSite News. You can see here an article they published, I believe it was in November of last year, and they wrote, an Israeli military intelligence officer stayed at Epstein's Manhattan apartment. It's not an apartment, it's a massive mansion, as we covered in a report we published yesterday, with, you know, pictures of naked minor females all over the place. And he stayed there, this spy, on at least three occasions, including once in February 2013 while working as a senior aide to then Israeli Minister of Defense, Ehud Barak. So, and it goes on and talks about other ways in which Yoni Koren was involved with of Epstein. And on top of that, I'll just point out one other fact. There is the revelation. Sorry, I don't think that's the one we're looking for. This revelation. Rami, can you just pull up number 7, please? I think we're, there we go. Thank you. This is a December 10th, 2014 email from Epstein to Melanie Spinella, and he wrote, Gratz, Charity, Herzog, Ehud, coming to Island this weekend. Come plane 3 issue. I don't know what the hell that means, but in any event, this is very likely a reference to none other than the war criminal Isaac Herzog, the current president of Israel. He appears to have gone to Epstein Island, again, a den of depravity, in 2014. So this is just scraping the surface of the evidence which shows that Epstein was working with Israeli intelligence and it was in some way working in and for the state of Israel. So Netanyahu and company have a huge uphill battle from a public relations perspective if they're going to try to persuade people that Epstein was not somehow working with or for the Mossad. So yeah, for all of those reasons, folks, I'm highly confident that the Epstein files will be high on the agenda when Netanyahu meets with Trump on Wednesday. The most important question for us is, what can we expect to emerge from that meeting? And based on what happened after the last time they met during heightened attention to the Epstein scandal, we have reason to be very concerned. I think they are going to talk about doing all kinds of dastardly evil shit to bury the story yet again. And of course, one way they might do that is by finally launching their much cherished war on Iran again, with untold consequences for us all. But I also wouldn't rule out something else, something even more surprising, less expected. And I'm not saying this is going to happen. I don't have any evidence to suggest that it will, but I'm just throwing this out there as one way they might try to deal with the public relations crisis that they're in, and that is a false flag. I wouldn't even rule out the possibility that some crazy shit happens at the Super Bowl tonight. But again, I'm not saying that's going to happen. I don't have any evidence to suggest it's going to happen. I'm just saying that this is the way these people think. I've seen some reports in the last few days that some Israeli was arrested in California. There are allegations that he was operating a biolab. He's been charged with firearms offenses. I don't know what that's all about, and I haven't had time to really investigate it, but keep your eyes open, because I think we're looking at a very tumultuous several weeks ahead as these two criminals try to bury the evidence of their involvement with Epstein. So finally, I want to talk about Iran's negotiating position. Let's recall that Israel is the only state in West Asia that has nukes. It's the only state that is not a party to the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, or the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and it doesn't undergo and never has independent inspections of its nuclear facilities. So for it to be demanding that Iran deprive itself of the ability to enrich uranium, which Israel does to weapons grade, is outrageous. It's outrageous that the media keeps repeating uncritically the demands of Israel, the purported concerns of Israel and the United States over Iran's nuclear program without mentioning Israel's nukes. If we should be concerned about anybody's nukes or nuclear program, it should be Israel. Because after the way this psychopathic entity has behaved, particularly during the last 2+ years of genocide, there is every prospect that these people would use nuclear weapons. In fact, they're the most likely candidate to use nuclear weapons against a state that hasn't attacked them. So how can it be right that they are trying to deprive Iran of the ability even to enrich uranium for civilian purposes when Israel enriches to the level of weapons grade uranium and has nukes and is committing genocide? And if the Iranians actually complied with the demands, including the the emasculation of their conventional ballistic missile program, or if for any reason the current government of Iran were to fall, I think we should anticipate that what they're going to do is they're going to destroy the country. If they can actually bomb the bejesus out of Iran, demolish its essential infrastructure, demolish its military capacity to defend itself, and do that with little risk of harm to themselves, they'll do it just as they did in Syria. After Assad fell, they went hog wild in bombing and occupying even more territory in Syria. Their goal is to destroy, not just regime change. Their goal is to destroy and dismember Iran so that whoever comes to power in the future, it will not be able to resist Israeli-American hegemony over the region. And so all those people out there who are being critical of the Iranian government and hoping and wishing that it falls, my message to you is this, that whatever you may think about it, and however justified your criticisms of it may be, the only thing right now that is standing in the way of the destruction of Iran as a viable state is that government. That's it. You may not like that. You may wish it weren't true, but that's the reality. And so if you care about the people of Iran and you care about the sovereignty of Iran, at this particular moment, you shouldn't be out there cheerleading for this government to fall, because who's going to defend Iran if that happens? Is it going to be the son of the Shah? Really? That corrupt little twerp is going to defend Iranian sovereignty from the Americans and the Israelis? I don't think so. And in light of all this, you know, Rami, and I'm curious your thoughts about this, I wonder why Iran even bothers. I have some theories about this, but why is Iran even bothering to talk to these shyster, you know, criminals, these genocidal lunatics, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who know absolutely nothing about Iran? They know next to nothing about the region. They are con artists who, at least Witkoff, before Kushner entered the Iran negotiations, he tried to lull Iran into a false sense of security while Israel was preparing to attack it. So I've been wondering a lot about why they even bother talking to these criminals. And I have theory about this, but I'm curious, Remy, do you have a theory about this?
Well, I think there's a very clear pattern between the resistance in Gaza negotiating with Israel and the United States for the so-called ceasefire, as well with Russia, that has been part of thousands of rounds of negotiations with Ukraine to put an end to this war in Ukraine, and as well as Iran, which is, I mean, sometimes I also ask myself this question. It's absurd to even negotiate with the United States knowing the track record that they have. But I think that the reality is that Russia, Hamas, the resistance in Gaza, as well as Iran, need to show openness to their people back home that they're doing all their efforts they can to bring an end to the war. And I think not everyone is knowledgeable within these countries, right, about the reality of how geopolitics works. But the reality is that they need to entertain all avenues to then say, we've exhausted all efforts. This is the last opportunity available to us. Because sometimes I ask myself the same question about Gaza. Why is the resistance participating in these negotiations for ceasefire? We see Israel violating every single measure in the ceasefire, yet we're still invested in it. Same thing for Russia. Russia, 2 months into this, special military operation, to this war, signed an agreement to put an end. They withdrew from Kharkiv. They withdrew from many of these territories, only to see Ukraine and NATO not participate. But the reality is that in some ways, Russia and Palestine are much more democratic countries. These governments need to win the support of their people every single day. The United States, not so much. Israel, not so much. They just need to win the support of the elite. Hence why I think we are in a bit of a different situation, and we need to sit down at the table and negotiate with the United States, all while understanding that these are basically Trojan horses meant to open the door while we manufacture consent in the West, while my fellow colleagues in Canada are participating in legitimizing the invasion of Iran, right? This whole part of negotiation is meant to create this charade that we've done everything that we can to negotiate with Iran, and now the next step is to invade. But I think the onus is on us.
I agree. I think this is very likely. Iran is trying in good faith to have a discussion with them within reasonable limits, because that's what a lot of people in Iran want. They want them to make an effort. I think probably Russian and Chinese governments want to see the Iranians at least make an effort. I think the Iranians themselves want people in the broader world to see that they're reasonable people. And another thing that might be going on here, Rami, is that they are trying to buy time because they need more time to prepare for an attack. You know, they've got people perhaps being trained on new air defense systems. Maybe they have new missile systems that they have to work out. You know, there have been reports that they got advanced Russian fighter jets and their pilots may be training. So it may be that every day that passes is a day that they become stronger in their ability to defend themselves from these monsters. So there are a number of legitimate reasons why they might be doing that. One thing I will say sort of in passing, I have a lot of admiration for the courage of this Iranian foreign minister, because he's going out there into the broader world and is, I think, making a pretty good case for Iran. He's soft-spoken. He speaks English well. He's an elegantly attired man. He seems reasonable. he's the kind of spokesperson that the Americans and the Israelis don't want, you know, any resistance group or any state that resists U.S. hegemony to have. And these mofos are perfectly capable of killing this man. And if they decide they want to go down that path and have another war, I think he's going to be at or near the top of their target list. I doubt very much that he doesn't understand that. I think he probably does understand that. And yet he continues to go out into the world in situations where he's leaving himself vulnerable to some assassination attempt and to do the best that he can to represent his country. We'll have to see how that all unfolds. The last thing I want to just share on this subject of why Netanyahu went to or is coming again to Washington is this little tidbit. This little report that sneaked into the Israeli media today. Israeli court cancels Netanyahu trial hearings ahead of White House visit. So what happened was the judges presiding over Netanyahu's corruption trial approved his request to cancel hearings scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday following his announcement that he will travel to Washington. So the criminal, the mafioso, managed to get a further delay in the hearing of his corruption trial by saying, hey, guess what? I'm going back to Washington. So I'm sure that also was a little bit of a factor. So